I would much prefer to teach this to you by making you into small groups and teaching you small group dynamic activity. Unfortunately, one of the things about a small group is the fact that it takes time. And that's the first thing to remember about small group dynamics. You're going to learn more in small groups than you will learn in any other way if what you're after is a comparing of value systems or taking information and running it up the scale of knowledge until it becomes a part of a person's life. So there are certain times when small groups are not effective. For our purposes tonight, small groups are not effective because it would take too long. And what you want is just basic intellectual content. And that's all we can have in the brief period of time that is allotted for this. Therefore, the way we are seated tonight is appropriate for a lecture, which is what this is. This is lecture seating. You are not organized to interact with each other. You're organized to sit and listen, and that's what you've been doing all week. And yet, if you're going to take this information and to do anything with it, it has to go up the scale from just understanding it to being able to work it into a form where it can be usable and practice it so that it can go out into your lifestyle as a regular part of the way you live and move and have your being. That's where small groups come in. Now, there are many, many scores and scores of ways that small groups can be useful. And to me, the most important way of all is in evangelism. I could wish that in Reach Out we had touch ministries that were small group ministries. I have talked to Barry about this, and he is, I think, right when he says that the typical worker in a Southern Baptist church who's working with youth is not capable of handling small group activity yet. That we're a few years away from the time when they'll be ready to do this. I would hope that it would come in a hurry and you might be the harbingers of this in the beginning. Because small group evangelism is infinitely more powerful than any other kind. Now, if the only kind of evangelism you're doing now is personal evangelism and lecture evangelism in meetings, you're probably missing a very important ministry. Because value systems are best communicated in small group settings. And it is, remember, on the basis of a value system that a person eventually will make a commitment to receive Jesus Christ as their Lord. So I just can't overestimate your importance in using small groups. And I can't underestimate the significance of what you're going to do in just thinking about this tonight. Now, we have developed in our church in Houston and in our ministries in Singapore with Singapore Baptists a very highly sophisticated small group evangelism, which we call touch ministries. We first used the word, and Barry picked it up, and he's using it in a completely different way in your material to talk about just a touch on a campus. But for us, a touch ministry is an experience, a small group experience, between Christians and non-Christians. And I'm perfectly delighted that it's being used in both ways, because it's actually more appropriate in the way Barry is using it perhaps in the way we're using it. But here in a small group ministry, a group of Christians and non-Christians have a chance to share value systems. And we've discovered this over and over again. Whether the group has the content of guitar playing or how to fall in love successfully or interior decorating or principles of business management or how to study more effectively, or any of the scores and scores of things that you can do with a small group in pre-evangelism touch ministries. Always, when you put Christians in a group with non-Christians, if it's just playing the guitar, the value system of the Christian is communicated, recognized, and pondered by the non-Christian. Therefore, small groups are very, very important and extremely valuable. With that introduction, I would like to try to give you some practical pointers about small group activity that will help you. The first one is the physical arrangement of the people when they enter the room. When you're going to have a small group meeting, whether it's a Sunday school class, which can be a small group if it isn't a lecture, or whether it is any other kind of activity, maybe you're asking kids to organize themselves to talk with you about something. Maybe it's a committee meeting, which is actually a kind of a small group activity, especially if it's a brainstorming session. The physical arrangement is important. If you are in a large room, maybe your own living room, do not push the chairs against the walls and have big empty space in the middle. If you have to rearrange the room from the normal way you have it by getting the coffee table out of the middle and pushing some of the chairs over toward the couch, try to have people as close as possible physically to one another. Now, you can overdo it. If you have a circle of chairs and there isn't anything in the middle of the circle, people can be threatened if you are physically too close to each other. If we had these folding chairs, especially if we had fellows and girls, we would want to have a little space between them and a large enough space in the middle so that there wasn't a feeling that somebody is crowding on me. But the best way to organize yourself is around the table. The mass of the table connects the bodies of the participants together. They have a place where they can put their elbows or their coffee or whatever. So whenever possible, I will choose a dining room rather than a living room if we're in a home for a small group activity. And in that setting, you have two kinds of tables. You have a square a rectangular table like this, and much, much better, if you can have it, you can't always, is a round table. I like the Chinese because they don't like tables like this. They don't make tables like this. And any restaurant you go in will be a round table because they really know how to fellowship around food. So their tables are always round. So if you can have a round table, great. If you can't, use a rectangular table. But if you sit at the head of the table and you don't want to be the head of that small group meeting, then you're in trouble. Never, ever, if you want to melt into the crowd, sit at the head of a table. Get in the middle of it. If we were going to have a small group meeting here and I wanted group dynamics that wouldn't center around me, I'd never sit at the head because they would automatically all focus on me. So I'd sit in the middle, and then things will kind of rotate around me, and that person is always going to be a critical person in the group. Unless it's Casper Milquetoast, who never opens his mouth at all, he will give you trouble, but anybody else will have a special dominant position just by sitting at the head of the table. Now, endlessly, I have to fight this one, this battle that I'm going to talk about next, over and over and over and over again. I get a small group, and somebody slips in late, and they don't want to sit in the circle. They don't want to sit like this. They say, oh dear, I'll disturb the group if I might everybody slide over. So they kind of get their chair and they put it behind like that, and that totally annihilates small group dynamics for the evening if you don't stop right then and there and say, Mary, we're glad to have you tonight. Susan and Phyllis, slide your chairs. Mary, come on in. Oh, no, I don't want to. Mary, get in here, because this person is not going to be open with somebody looking at the back of her head. You read eyes in group dynamics. Now, if I look at your eyes, I see your head nodding, or I see your defense mechanism, you know, the folded arms, the folded legs, the hunched over. When I see that sort of thing, that gives me signals. And then that'll ruin a group. And if you ever do that in a group, I hope lightning strikes you. Never, ever allow that to happen. If you want true group dynamics, you must always have one circle. Not one circle with a second circle behind it, like I've seen some people do. If you want to have real group activity, everybody has to be equal and in a situation where they can interact. So, in this situation, don't take this chair, take this chair. And in this situation, or any other, don't let somebody sit behind anybody else. Now, when a group of people come together, how large should a group be? This is one of the most critical points in small group dynamics. I talk to you and you talk to me. There are two lines of communication when two people are talking. As we're talking, a third person enters the conversation. Now we have 2, 4, 6 lines of communication. We've added one person and gone from 2 to 6 lines of communication. I add a fourth person to the group, and in addition to this 6, I have 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I go from 4 to 12. And by the time I get to 8 people, I've got so many lines of communication going that when I add person number 9, I destroy the small group dynamics and they no longer cease to effectively function. You should never put more than 8 people in a small group if you want effective dynamics. The minute you add the 9th person, you're going to have subgroups. You'll have 5 in one and 4 in the other. And the minute there's a break in the conversation, you will find these people beginning to whisper here. And it won't happen if you stay under 8. Now, you can have as few as 3 in a small group, but never go more than 8. And when you do that, you also determine the size of the group by the amount of time you have for a group activity. For example, the first evening with a group of people, one of the best ways to get acquainted that I know about are the Quaker questions. There are 4 Quaker questions. Where did you live between the ages of 7 and 12? And how many brothers and sisters did you have? Question number 2, how did you heat your house? Question number 3, who was the warmest person in your life during those years? Question number 4, when did God become more than just a word in your life? Now, if you have that, and you start it off, and you should kick it off yourself and set the scene for it, because if you say, all right, the first question is, where did you live between the ages of 7 and 12, and how many brothers and sisters did you have? All right, it's your turn. Well, what's he going to do? If that's Mr. Blabbermouth, you're going to get 5 minutes out of him, and then everybody is going to think they have to go 5 minutes, and you go crazy. And if he's Mr. Tell It Quickly, he's going to say, I lived in Cleveland, I had 2 brothers. Around the circle you go. In no time at all, you're on question 2, and you haven't developed the dynamics that you need. So you always set the scene by doing it yourself. And everybody is delighted that you do it because they're scared to death. You say, all right, I'll kick it off. Between the ages of 7 and 12, we lived in 2 towns. We lived in Elyria, Ohio. And we lived in a great, big, huge, old pre-Civil War mansion that the First Baptist Church had bought there. And it had a great, big, huge basement. My brother and I used to sell roller skating tickets for a penny. And the kids would come down and roller skate around the furnace in the basement. And I had one brother, and he was David. And when he was 8 years of age, he was hit by a train. He lived, but it was a very traumatic experience. Now it's your turn. Okay, I've taken about a minute. I've given some detail. That sets the scene. Everyone else will do the same. But if you have 8 people in a group and you're going to take 1 minute each, that's 8 minutes for the first question and 16 minutes by the end of the second question, and you have a total of 32 minutes at minimum invested with the 8 people in a circle. Now, it's obvious that if you cut your group by half and you have 4 in this group and 4 in this group, it'll only take you half as much time. So many times, time is the factor determining how large your groups are going to be. There can be other reasons as well, but never go over 8 people in a group. All right, now, another thing I want to indicate is that when you get a group of people together for the first time, there are some very dangerous group dynamics that have to be disposed of. And these are the dynamics of fear, defensiveness, that are automatically raised because I don't know you and I don't know what you're like, but I've got to find out a way to relate to you. And I look at you and you look like somebody in my past. Your hair is like my mother's hair. And I love my mother, so, well, you're going to be okay in this group. And you wear a mustache. And my father wore a mustache, and he was a drunk. And I automatically don't like anybody with a mustache. So I don't like you. You would be amazed, if you would stop to think about it, of the number of people this week that you positively or negatively related to instantly on the basis of nothing more than their physical features. And so the most important thing in getting a small group structured is to break down these prejudices, these negative and positive dynamics, so that the real people can stand up. Here are the possibilities between only two people in a small group. I like you, you're neutral toward me. I like you and you like me. I like you and you don't like me. I don't like you and you do like me. I don't like you and you're neutral toward me. I don't like you and you don't like me. I'm blah toward you and you're blah toward me. I'm blah toward you and you're positive toward me. I'm blah toward you and you're negative toward me. 9 different possibilities between the two of us multiplied by 8 in the group. So within each one of these lines of communication, just this one line between two people in the group, you multiply that by 8 for the possible dynamics that are going to go on between those two people. Now, a lot of people fail in using small groups for things because they don't understand this problem. You simply must spend a lot of time letting the real people emerge, the real persons emerge, and the memories that are connected with faces be buried before you can get on with any dynamic activity in a small group. Therefore, I would like to suggest to you that an effective small group should last about 10 weeks. Now, I know you can do it in shorter periods of time, and through the years, I've experimented with many, many different ways to do this. A Sunday school quarterly runs 13 weeks, and 13 weeks is a bit too long. You don't have to go that long. I have tried 5-week groups, and they're just not long enough to get the impact that you need. A 10-week-long small group gives you maximum saturation between the participants. And each one of those weeks of meeting should be 1.5 hours in length. 1 hour small groups are almost always a waste of time. And the reason is because it takes about an hour every time for people to settle down and really become aware of each other on deep levels. You don't do that in a hurry. And no matter how many times you've met, the first hour is... I'm getting into some stuff here that will take too long to explain. There are 2 levels of conversation that go on between people. I call them phatic and impact levels. Phatic relationships are relationships in which I'm here and you're there and it's, hello, how are you? Nice day, isn't it? How's the weather? You think it'll rain anymore tomorrow? Are you going to have a nice trip home? How'd you enjoy the thing? That's phatic talk. That's just we recognize the presence of each other. But when you get down to impact talk, you're at gut level talk. And no matter how many times a group meets, it's going to take them somewhere around an hour to really get down to the gut level. So if you run a group for only an hour because it's training union and you want to have this at the regular training union time and it's an hour long and so you box yourself into that, you will never have the impact because it's the last 20 to 30 minutes in a small group meeting that lasts for an hour and a half that everything happens. And the gangbusters and the dynamics always occur in that last 20 minutes. I have spent endless hours in small group meetings of all sorts, pre-evangelism small group meetings, of many, many, many types and descriptions. I've been in therapy as a co-therapist with Dr. Juanita Hart, who is a member of our church and a psychiatrist. And I've gone in as a theologian with her, sometimes as a co-therapist with her, sometimes in her office professionally, sometimes in our building where we've done a tremendous amount of counseling in small groups. And it doesn't matter what kind of group it is. It's always going to be the same. The last 20 minutes are going to have the big impact. So you've got to go an hour and a half with your group. Now, when you start, spend the whole first hour and a half the first week doing nothing but cementing relationships. And the second week, spend 45 minutes of the time cementing relationships. And when the group regathers after that, spend from 10 to 15 minutes at the beginning each time cementing relationships. The 10th week is a farewell. You have a big blowout. You pass the hat through here, you collect all the money at session 9, you add it up, you decide what you're going to do, you go out and you have a dinner, you have a farewell, you have a celebration. I've got a lot of stuff in print about what to do all the way through here and how to prepare for the celebration beginning with the 7th session and all of that. And we don't have time to get into that, but just to give you a skeleton that you can fill in with whatever you want to. Small group dynamic activities through here. The Quaker Questions is excellent here. A possibility among 200 or 300 you could use here. Give everybody a copy of today's newspaper and a pair of scissors and some paste and some blank white paper and say, cut out and paste on this piece of paper two things that you're afraid of and two things that you're interested in paste it on this piece of paper. Cut it out of the paper. It may be an article about something. It may be an advertisement about something you're interested in, your photography bug. You can cut out a photographic ad or whatever, and then we'll go around the circle and we'll share it. Now, you do that sort of thing here, and you try to develop an understanding of each other. When you get to these things, they can be a lot shorter, and there's just an endless number of things that can be done. But you must every time begin with group dynamics. And the smartest thing to do is to serve the refreshments as the people sit down, never at the end of the meeting or halfway through the meeting. When they come in, have the coffee and have the refreshments ready, they pick it up, they take it to the table, put the cookies in the middle of the table, have a coffee pot on the side, and let them have it at the beginning. It develops a spirit of conviviality and belonging to one another, and you go through the session together. Doing that. Now, this section in here is reserved for your activity. This can be anything. It can be your Bible study, if it's a Bible study group. It can be guitar playing, or lonely people, or personality development, or how to fall in love successfully, or it can be a leadership training course. If you want to have group dynamics and effectively mold a group of people that you're training in how to run reach out, I'd run that same pattern. Now, in Houston, we have had Bible study groups that have recycled every 10 weeks for about 6 years now. We have one that just had its 6th anniversary. Those women have met for 6 years, 10 weeks at a time. You always have a cutoff point. One lady said to me one time, I went to grade school, I graduated. I went to high school, I graduated. I went to college, I graduated. I've been going to training union all my life. When do you graduate from the crazy thing? And one of the important things about a small group is that there is a point where you can gracefully get off. Now, another thing is this. Seal relationships in session 1 with a covenant. The covenant should be basically prepared by the group itself, although it's usually wise to develop a skeleton in connection with it. But there ought to be ground rules set forth, not by you as the leader, but by all of those who are going to be participating in the group. And let the covenant come, let it be discussed, and then let everybody sign everybody else's copy of the covenant. So I go home the first night, and we agree that we will start promptly at 7:30, that we will always stop promptly at 9 o'clock, that I will be responsible for refreshments 1 out of 10 times, and the ground rules include no killer statements, and you did talk about what a killer statement is. You may or may not want to put that in all groups, but you put down these things, and you say, okay, has everybody agreed on this? And everybody has agreed, and then everybody signs everybody else's covenant, and you have a ceiling. Now, I don't do that up here. You scare them to death. I go through the Quaker questions, and I do it at the last half of that first meeting, somewhere toward the end of it. We discuss that. I always stop at the end of an hour and a half, and I say, look, this is a time when we quit. What do you say? Do we need to go? If so, let's agree that we'll dismiss. And if some of you want to hang around and talk afterward, you can. And if the whole group says, no, let's go on. Say, okay, it's your problem now, not mine. We had a chance to quit, and now we can go until you're ready. And then let the group go on. My experience is that if you have an effective small group, they'll go from 2 to 2.5 hours regularly and never, ever be upset by it. So you seal it with a covenant here. And you develop your dynamics, you go into your activity, you let the activity develop. Now, never give the group anything heavy before session 5. Let me give you an example of something that I would consider heavy. In the class on personality development, one of the things that we deal with is how to handle conflict. And we do that in session 8. We want the group to really know each other so they can handle this. And in that group, we have this small group dynamic game that takes up about this much of it. And then we talk about how we felt for the last half of it. But here's what we do. We say, okay, here's a slip of paper. You read this one, you read this slip, you read this slip, you read this slip. Everybody takes an envelope, they open it up. And the same thing is told to all of them. You are working in an office. And in this office, you have been an employee for X number of years. So then we go around. You've been there 9 years. You've been there 7 years. You've been there 6 months. We give everybody different seniority. Then we describe their typewriter to them. You've been here 9 years. You're the oldest. And you have the newest typewriter. But after all, the oldest person deserves to get the best. And you've taken pretty good care of it. And then we say to the six-monther, you've got the old clunker typewriter, and yet you do more typing than anybody else in the whole group. And the person who's been there 3 years, you have to work overtime because you take real good care of your typewriter, and the cleaning man knocked your typewriter on the floor and smashed it, and now it doesn't work right. And every time you make a mistake, you have to erase 6 copies. Nobody else has to do 6 copies. And so we get all these dynamics set. And then the manager says, okay, I'm the manager of this office, and I have just been told that we can have one brand new IBM Selectric typewriter next week. And I'm supposed to decide who to give it to, but every time in the past I've done this, everybody gets mad at me. So this time, I'm going to let you decide among yourselves who gets the new typewriter. And you got 15 minutes to decide who's going to get it. And boy, they go at it. You know, it's role-playing then. You know, well, I want it. And I have seen fantastic differences in what Chinese people do with this and what Americans do with it. You would be amazed at the difference between cultures with this one. But you can really get some heavy dynamics going. Now, you try that about session 2, and you're going to have half the group out from then on. Do it session 8, and you'll get away with it. So you don't give them heavy stuff in the beginning. You give them light stuff here. And you move on in. But it's amazing the amount of activity that can really change a human life in only 15 hours in small group ministry and small group activity. I could go on endlessly about this. I've been working and studying and practicing and developing small group activity like this ever since about 1952, and I've just got books and books and books that I've read on it. So I think I'll just stop here now. That's half my time, and we'll use the other half and just let you ask questions. Yes?
You said that you had a lot of materials on getting the group started. Does that mean stuff that you've read or that you just used?
Both.
What about the things that you've written on there?
Yes, they are. Right now, we are. Tommy Alford is rewriting a 182-page manual I have, and that manual should be available in mimeograph form around the first of the year, and then we'll look for a publisher. We'll either publish it ourselves or maybe give it to Zondervan or Brodmann, so that it'll be out later. But if you'd like to have that, you can. Now, William Bangham has a little book, and David Haney took this fellow who was a member of his church. Bill Bangham was a member of his church. And Bill has stolen most of my thunder, and I don't mind that at all. But a whole lot of the things that I'd say are in Bill Bangham's book, and that's a real good book to start with. I think it's called Discipleship Through Small Groups. It's one of those three little booklets that are put out by the Brotherhood Commission. I have one.
Journey into Small Groups.
Yeah, Journey into Small Groups. That's very, very good. And I have a lot of material along with it, and there are a whole lot of sources. There's an outfit in California that has volume after volume after volume of small group activity and exercises that you can use. Carefully indexed so you can flip through and just get all kinds of fantastic small group things that you can do for many different kinds of situations. Openers, things that you use here, things that you use to close, things that you use along in here, things for different dynamics. And those are called structured exercises, something or other. It's by University Associates Incorporated in, I think, La Jolla, California. If any of you want that, give me your name on a slip of paper, and I'll send it to you when I get home. Yes?
It seems, sir, the time element here automatically rules the use of this small group out of any present church structure that we have. I mean, you couldn't use a training union or Sunday school or Wednesday, possibly maybe Wednesday night, depending on how long you want to meet. But it seems like this has obviously got to be outside your present church structure. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's all I have to say about it.
Unless you have that says prayer meeting, not the most important thing in the world.
Pardon?
Unless you have a pastor that says prayer meeting is not the most important thing in the world when you come to.
Blessed be the name of the pastor.
where does the leader fit in, like in the activities? Should the leader participate in something?
Oh, that's a great question. Now, there are different ways that you can function in a small group. You can function according to the fan principle, and in the fan, you're here, and the others are out here, and the communication goes like this, typical Sunday school class. That's the fan principle. And there are times when this is necessary, and that time is when you have an expert who is sharing a concept and people are coming back to ask questions about it and get answers. That's a kind of a tutorial type of small group, where you have a tutor or a teacher in the midst. And then there are other types of small groups, and these are the ones that I enjoy the most, in which there is no leader, in which everyone is equal. And in a small group like this, the thing that you need to do is to make your contribution as a group member rather than as Mr. Expert. And that's a lot more fun. Now, in a touch ministry where we have two Christians and six non-Christians, we encourage the Christian to kick it off in session one and get it going. And from then on, we rotate through the sessions with a different person leading each time. So the second session, you got a non-Christian leading. The third session, you got a non-Christian leading. It puts you in the beautiful position of just being a participant. And what you throw out on the table is not what the expert says, it's just what another member of the group says. And you have a wholly, completely different dynamic to your relationship with people when you do that. Now, if we had time, I could prove to you how easily this works. I could break you up into groups of five tonight. And I could say, come up with an answer to Women's Lib. And you have 2 minutes to do it in. I could just take any subject out of the blue and give you 2 minutes, and within the first minute, a leader would emerge in your group. It will almost always happen. So, sometimes in small group activity, you can get into something like that and just throw out two or three things and deliberately don't appoint anybody as the leader. Just say, okay, let the whole group just discuss this. And it won't be long before one person will emerge as the leader. And then that person will become the focal point for the group. Now, sometimes if you're trying to develop leadership, that's a very good thing to do.
But there is another way you can handle it if you want to avoid that happening. And that is, take something that's rather nonsensical, if you want to. You can say, all right, the person who has the newest pair of shoes on their feet is going to lead this next activity. And the next activity is so-and-so and so-and-so. Okay, find your leader. And everybody says, ah, how old are your shoes? Oh, look at mine. Oh, these have holes in them. I'm not it, you know. And they go around, oh, you're the leader. And it can be Casper Milk Toast, or it can be just anybody in the group. In Singapore, I used to say, the person who last ate durian will be your leader. And they'd all laugh over that, because durian is the thing that smells so bad. Okay, now a dominant person in a group is always a big problem. And the way you handle a dominant person is, number one, with your covenant. The best way to handle a problem is to anticipate it and cut it off before it happens. And so before anybody does that, and you've got ego on the line, you, in your ground rules, you can say, we agree that no person in the group will speak twice until everybody else who wants to speak has had a chance to speak once. And you can put some things in that will sensitize to that. Now, the next thing you do is, you get that blabbermouth and he's in there, and you ask yourself why. You sit there and you think to yourself, why is that person a blabbermouth? Now, a blabbermouth can be that way for a lot of reasons. And the most simplistic reason is, he just does never have anybody to talk to until he gets to this group. All right, that's easy to handle. But here's a person who's terribly insecure, and they're like a little boy holding onto his papa's hand as they walk through the graveyard in the middle of the night. And he thinks if he talks a blue streak to his daddy, that it'll keep the ghosts away. And many people speak out of fear. They're just scared that if they stop the word, somebody would penetrate and hurt them. So here's a person functioning out of real low self-image. And here's another person who's a blabbermouth out of anger. They're attacking all the time. And you really need to get a feel for why the person is over-talkative. And then that gives you a clue as to how to handle them. And there are some people that I can go up to after the group and say, hey, Bill, let me show you something tonight. While we were talking, each time somebody talked, I put a circle around them. And, you know, Mary talked twice. George didn't talk at all. And each of these people spoke twice. Let me show you something. And I show him his circle like that. And I say, that's what happened tonight. How do you feel about that? Now, that's one way you can handle it. You have to have the right relationship to do it. There are other more tactful ways. Another way is to sit back and do nothing, because a group will shut them up. It's amazing what will happen if you decide that you don't have to solve all the problems in a group and just let it happen. The group will clam them up. They'll have their way of doing it. Another way you can do it, and I do this often with somebody who's, you know, I don't know what else to do, I'll say, let me show you the diagram. The last 5 minutes of our group tonight, you spoke about 7 times, and Mary never spoke 1 time. I really wonder what Mary's thinking. Next week, would you be a gate opener for me? What's a gate opener? Well, a gate opener is somebody who tries to get someone else to open up. So the next time, maybe you really do have something that you'd like to contribute, but instead of contributing it, why don't you help me by saying, Mary, what do you think about this? Or George, what do you think about this? When they do it, I give them a nod and they know, oh yeah, I'm helping. I'm helping in the group. And it sensitizes them to the fact that they're talking too much without hurting them. There are a number of other ways you can handle this, but these are just a few, okay?
What type of activities can you suggest in terms of having a small group situation where you're trying to evangelize some of the people?
Where you're trying to evangelize. It's not pre-evangelism. It's evangelism, right? Okay, now I got to have some suppositions with you. The first supposition is these people want to be evangelized. They know they're coming to be evangelized. Is that the way it is or not?
I hadn't really thought about it.
Okay, now that's really critical. Because if you try to manipulate a person in a small group and then get them in there and try to evangelize them, they're going to be madder than hops. I'd be and you'd be. So, when you ask your question, let me divide it into two groups. A pre-evangelism group, let's say how to fall in love successfully, is a group in which you give them a quality 10-week experience. And when they're done, they know how to fall in love successfully. The young man who wrote that material for me is a bachelor. He's never been married. He's never fallen in love successfully. But he knows his onions. It's just a matter of time for him. And the first time we put on this pre-evangelism group, How to Fall in Love Successfully, we had a couple get engaged at the celebration. They announced their engagement. They'd fallen in love in the flat. So we knew it really worked. We had a benediction on it. But in that situation, we never deal directly with Jesus Christ or how to be saved in the group. What we're doing is letting them compare value systems, and outside the group, on a one-to-one basis, we talk about the Lord Jesus. Now, the other thing. Maybe you meet a pagan right here. Man, he wouldn't be caught dead in his coffin in a Bible study. You take him this. And at the celebration, the group says, man, we've had so much fun, we just like to stay together. And you say, well, we kind of anticipated this. And we've got a skeptics class. We've got a class for people, and they want to know answers to 10 basic questions that most people don't understand about Christianity. Example, are there any contradictions in the Bible? Another night we're going to deal with how can a good God send anybody to hell? And another night we're going to talk about how can God send people into eternity and not let them go to heaven if they live in a foreign country and they've never ever heard of Jesus Christ. And you list these things. I've got those lists and all that stuff. So you say, we're going to deal with these things. And if you'd like to come, you're invited to come. And the person says, yeah, I want to come. Now, in that situation, that is an evangelism small group. They know they're coming to wrestle with issues. Now, in that case, I never pick myself as the expert. I want to get down with them again. And the way I can do that is very important. I take a paragraph of C.S. Lewis. And I pass it around, and we all read it. And then we say, okay, let's talk about this. So it never becomes an argument between my ego and your ego, where if you throw something up and I disagree with you, I'm going to put you down by disagreeing, and then you're going to disagree with me till the cows come home, whether I'm right or not, just because you're not going to let me be smarter than you are. And so you can never do that in an evangelism small group. You can never get into that situation where it's, well, I know more than you do, and I believe this. Well, I believe this. Well, let me show you three reasons why you're wrong. Oh, now you've got my ego up, buddy, for the rest of the time. You're not gonna be smarter than I am, and that's the last time I'm coming to this group. You know, tonight's the end. So you never do that. You always become impartial along with them, and you put something out in the middle of the table, like a paragraph from C.S. Lewis, or you give a situation, or you get involved in role play or whatever. But that's a good way to do it, okay?
If in a pre-evangelistic group, topic comes up or the question comes up about God, and it starts working into that, as you as a leader, do you put the kibosh on that?
No. The ground rules are these. There are two Christians in this group. We don't apologize for that. We're doing this as a gift of love. This is not a religious group. We will not ever bring up religion. We'll never trick you that way. But anybody in this group, apart from the two of us, who wants to ask anything they want to about God in the group, you're free to do so. And at the time you do it, we'll ask the group to vote. Shall we stop the discussion and get into this religious discussion or not? And if the group says, okay, let's get into that. Does everybody agree? Anybody disagree? All right, let's do it. And have at it. We have had endless personality development groups that began with six non-Christians that we never could have gotten into a Bible study. By the fourth session, they were so involved in talking about religious factors that we went right on into a Bible study and scrapped it, never finished it. They said, well, let's forget about personality development. Let's just get into this matter of God. Now, that brings up something else that probably is worth sharing with you. There are three areas to all knowledge, and the kind of pre-evangelism group you offer is very critical. Let me show you what they are. There are three domains of knowledge. There is cognitive, there is affective, and there is psychomotor. All right, now let me give you some examples. A cognitive domain pre-evangelism subject would be how to study more effectively. That's a cognitive thing. It's a learning thing. I want to learn how to study. I'm using my mind. Basically, an effective domain activity, you get into spiritual things a whole lot faster than you will in the other groups, but that doesn't mean that you should only use effective domain activities. Because you're not going to have a chance to communicate with every non-Christian from that level. Not everybody is interested in personality development.
Can you give an example of an effective domain suggestion for a pre-evangelism group?
Personality development.
Well, can you elaborate on that again? I'm not sure if I follow you.
All right, okay. In this class, we learn how to have a better personality.
Oh, and that deals with personal
the development,
relationships.
No, the development of my personality. How to handle anger,
okay.
How to handle fear,
all right.
How to handle resentment, things like this.
Another thing I want to ask you, if I can back up a moment to the evangelism group.
Yes,
I would have a terrible time. You suggested something earlier that the leader, whoever he may be, he's got to be one with his group, particularly if you're dealing with some non-Christian participants and you're discussing a passage from C.S. Lewis. And a thought shot through my mind, because I'm like this. I would have to have the last word. I know I'd have the answer. And I know that's wrong, so that's what I wanted to ask you here, is that if this fellow has got sufficient argument against this passage and what C.S. Lewis may be bringing up, or whomever, should you let it die that way, or should you continue to offer a response to him if no one else in the group is? Are you willing to let the group dismiss itself the evening with the non-Christian seemingly having the better or the upper hand as far as the discussion is concerned?
The answer to that is one that is so varied that there isn't really any answer, but the response to it is never on the basis of, oh, I've got to send these people away with the gospel. No. You evaluate what you're going to do on this basis. What will be best for the group over this 10-week period? Maybe it's better for me to let them go home and think that's right and wait. Because if I do, I don't become the big expert and they don't expect me to answer every question and they go away and inside they're saying, he didn't answer that guy. I wonder what he thought. And invariably, in the next session, somebody will say, hey, what do you think about that? And then you have a right to speak. But it's very hard to do that unless you've done it long enough that you know how to anticipate group activity. But the people who are sitting in that room that know you're a committed Christian, and they know that you've let that guy get away with that, and you haven't fought him back, and they go away, and they'll worry about it all week. They'll say, I wonder what he thinks about that. Or why didn't he answer that? And almost invariably, they'll bring it up again. And if you play the role effectively of saying, okay, I'm just one with you. And when you want to know, you ask me. And you know, you don't ever say that, but by your manner and by your attitude, they'll do it. The longer I've worked in groups, the more I recognize, you just let them alone. You just let it happen. You just sit back and that guy's a big blabbermouth and you want to shut him up because you're afraid he's going to ruin your group. It's not your group. It's our group. They'll shut him up.
Nancy, how do you go about forming a group? Let's say two and six. A six non-Christians or two, you have the two Christians go in and touch base with the other six, invite them into that group?
Yes.
Or, in other words, that's somebody that they work with, say, or somebody they come in contact with in their neighborhood.
That's right. Or you can advertise in the newspaper. You can put it on the bulletin board or in front of our church on our bulletin board, we can change. We'll say, divorcee groups now forming. Call 497-2420. There are any infinite number of ways you can do it, but never do this until you thoroughly train those two people.
So, and then, so you don't, in your church, like saying, okay, we're starting a group of this now. Everybody who wants to talk about personality development, come join the group.
In my church? No, there are no pagans in my church.
That's what I'm saying.
I do it in the community.
We've got some pagans in our church.
To each his own.
What value would you consider the physical sensitivity exercise with a small group? To what extent would you use those kind of things?
Never. You mean this touchy-touchy deal? You don't have any business messing around with that, neither do I, and I am almost dead sure the people who do it don't either. There are a lot of weird things that are being done. And a lot of it is based upon Freudian psychology, and it's just kind of, let's get it all out and let's let it all hang out and all that business. And that's not smart.
Explain me the psychomotor groups. If I'm going to teach guitar, do I still do these? What kind of activities beforehand would I do that before we really get down and say, okay, this is where you place your fingers on the thing? I'm so geared to. If I'm going to be teaching that kind of thing, just get right in and say, okay, get your guitars out.
Okay, all right. If it's a guitar playing group, the first time you meet, you say, okay, next week we're all going to bring our guitars. Here's mine. If you're going to buy one, here's what you look for, and here's in the stem you hold it up the light, and how close are they, the frets, and all that business. And next week you bring it, and here's a little booklet, and it's got all the songs in it we're going to use. Now tonight we're going to get acquainted. And the next week they come and you say, now the first 45 minutes tonight, we're going to try to seal our group relationship, because we got two purposes in this group. One is to develop strong relationships and the other is to play the guitar. Now, in the rest of the guitar playing group, I don't do the 10-minute exercise in the beginning. And if you're a guitar player, you can tell me why. Because you're going to be playing the guitar for an hour and a half and you're new guitar players. Why do I do it in the middle, honey? Huh? No. No.
Fingers.
Boy, I tell you, if your fingers haven't been pushing down on those steel cords against those frets, after a few minutes, those fingers get to hurting like needles were in them. So in that group only, the creative exercise is a break in the middle so your fingers can rest. Those painful nerve endings that are hurting. So we do it in the middle, but you do your break right there. Now, every one of these creative exercises throughout the 10 weeks give you new insights into the value system of that non-Christian and give them new insights into your value system.
Do you still make sure they understand that you'll be doing this? Presupposing that they think they're just going to come for a half guitar lesson? That's kind of what I was...
No, we have a little 48-page booklet that they get with every one of these 10-week deals that they take home, they read at home, and the page 7 in every one of them is the same. It says, this group has two purposes. One is for you to make friends that you'll seal for a lifetime. The other is to learn to play the guitar. So we'll be doing both things. You expect that.
If getting some materials from you, or that manual, that booklet be included in that, just to give an idea of how.
Yeah, the stuff I have now is what I brought from Singapore. I only have samples, and we're having to Americanize all this. And it'll be about four or six months before it'll be ready. Yes, dear, it is in a foreign language. It's in Singapore English, Ma. You can read it. It's in English, but you wouldn't believe some of the differences in the English language around the world.
Yeah, a small group of Christians, like a leadership group, what things would you do different in this? One of them that started my leadership group just really couldn't open up the rest of us and dropped out.
Okay, you went too fast then. And maybe you didn't try to. But usually it's good to have a personal interview in a leadership group situation like that. I'd sit down with every person ahead of time and say, tell me where you are in your spiritual pilgrimage. And invariably, in addition to where they are in their spiritual pilgrimage, they'll throw out signals about where they are in their emotional pilgrimage. And if you know you got somebody in there that you're going to blow out of the saddle, you got to make a decision. Is it better to blow him out of the saddle because he really is never going to be effective as a leader until he matures a little more and he's not ready for it anyway? Or is this person important enough to me that I'll slow the whole group down and slowly bring them along with us? That's a value decision you have to make. Yeah.
Can an adult leader successfully fit into a small group setting with kids, you know, with teenagers? I've had some problems, not major, but some problems, just like Bible studies and things, with trying to get a group setting, and the kids throw everything back to me, and I don't want it.
Yes, you can. You can, in the same way that I can as a pastor of a church sitting among a bunch of laymen. But you can only do it when you give them a role-playing situation in which you're going to be an equal with them. You know what I mean by role-playing? Okay, you be Noah, and you be Noah's wife, and you be Noah's son Shem, and you be Ham, and you be Japheth, and I'll be the man that's coming down the road mocking Noah. You see, now I'm with them. We're all equal because we've changed our identities and we're playing roles. That kind of thing you can do. But in a lot of other situations, you're hung. And the best thing to do is to tell them what you want to do and then just kind of slide back and say, okay, kids, go ahead. Or you go ahead and do it while I go get the coffee and I'll be back in a little bit. Or the Cokes or whatever, you know, and I'll be back in a little bit. I understand your problem.
If you have a group that wants to continue after the 10 weeks, have you found it more effective to have a block of time where you don't meet, before you come back together?
No, I keep it cranked up right away, but give everybody a chance to drop out that wants to do so. Now close your group with week one. Don't keep adding people to a group. Invariably, they'll say, hey, I have a friend. They want to come and join me. It's week three. And you say, oh, that's great. Listen, we hope to get a new group started in about 2 weeks. Give me the name of your friend and I'll let her know. Well, she wants to be with me. All right? Would you like to join that group with her too? But that won't happen if in your covenant you agree, you know, we sign our name, that we will now close this group so that we can really be a family of people together. Because you plug a new person into a group 3 or 4 weeks along, you're back at square one again. And it'll never come alive the way you want it to. Watch for nonverbal signals. I think we all are aware of the importance of those. There are a lot of books written about that, body language, but that's really important.
Are there some basic things, basic commitments in all the covenants of all the groups?
Yes. Yes, there are. And in my material, I try to spell that out. I think Bangham does too, doesn't he? Doesn't Bangham have a model covenant in there? I think he does. I'm almost certain he does.
Have you been able to use a small group thing in your Bible study time?
Well, if it's pure Bible study, it's not small group activity. If it's pure Bible study, they're coming to soak in. And in that situation, it's not small group. Now remember, small groups work best when people already have knowledge and you want to work up that knowledge into their value system. Are you following me on that?
Mm-hmm.
They already have the knowledge. You want to work up that knowledge into their value system. Now, the Sunday school board's given the perfect way to do that. You got one guy who's a real expert. He stands, he lectures for the first half of the Sunday school hour, and then everybody breaks into small groups. They have small group leaders. They take what the guy has said, they work it up into their value system. That's an excellent pattern. And we have done some of that from time to time on a regular basis. Yes?
Have you ever done this type of thing like with just young people, or is this mostly what you do with adults?
Oh, man. There's no age limit to this.
The kids have been just as excited about going out and grabbing two of their friends that are lost and bringing them in, or three of their friends to do that?
Yes. Yes.
rap sessions for kids just before I left to go overseas were extremely effective. I haven't been back long enough to get into it. And I've been working on too many other problems in the church to get solved, and I'm not anywhere near this, but we'll be getting into teenage touch ministries very soon and producing our own materials. And when we do, we'll always do 3,000 or 4,000 so we can sell them to others, because there's always a big demand for this sort of thing when we get it worked out. Well, it's time to quit. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this. This is my last time with y'all, and it's just been a whole lot of fun to be here. I'll be a praying for you as you go back to wherever it is you go back to.